Okay. Hello, everybody. Nice to see you. And I'm happy that we clarified. We're going to have this class. Then we're going to have two more after this. If you want to know what we're going to talk about, just to whet your appetites, next week, we're going to talk about Giyur Ketanim. Giyur Ketanim means converting children and whether that's different. And what we're going to look at is we're going to look at some tshuvot that talk about the need to convert children in cities where literally the Jewish day school needed more children. And they went to Ramosha Feinstein and they asked them, can we convert the children? Because the Jewish day school needs Jewish children. So that's going to be another piece of American Jewish history. And the final week, just for fun, we can't go without this. And that is the question of men in the mikvah when women go into the mikvah, right? That's just an interesting question. And that is how things have changed over time. That means that the rabbis have to see the convert go into the mikvah. But what about if it's a woman convert and the three rabbis are men? How do you navigate that situation? So we'll also see some very modern kind of discussions of that topic. But for today, I want to do something different, a little different. And that is I want to tell you a story. We're going to look at material. We're going to look at some very interesting material. But first, I want to tell you a story. And the topic for today is the Denver Conversion Beit Din, 1977 to 1983. This is a story that is not well known enough. So share it with your friends. It's a fascinating story. Rabbi Stanley Wagner was a rabbi from Yeshiva University, from Reitz. He also had a PhD from Yeshiva University. He was really the linchpin of Orthodox Judaism in Denver. From 1972 until 1998, he was the rabbi of Beis Medrash HaGadol, an Orthodox shul in Denver. Now, this Orthodox shul is interesting on its own because it was one of the few Orthodox shuls that was part of the OU, even though it didn't have a mechitza. That in itself is a fascinating story. But he was clearly, he was the leading Orthodox rabbi in Denver. In 1977, Rabbi Wagner was meeting with a couple. They actually were philanthropists, contributors to his synagogue. And in the middle of the premarital meeting, he met with the parents and with the kids who were getting married. It turned out that the mother of the bride had a conservative conversion, meaning that she was converted by conservative rabbis, and that the mikveh that they used was a swimming pool. Rabbi Wagner gathered two other Orthodox rabbis, and he had the daughter immerse at the last minute before her wedding. The mother was very unhappy with the situation and couldn't believe that basically she had thought she was Jewish all these years, and now the rabbi was telling her that she wasn't Jewish. Now, with that story from 1977, I want to back up a little bit. The first Jews came to Denver in the 1859 gold rush. No, the Jews didn't go for the gold. The Jews were the ones who ran the grocery stores and they ran the clothing stores, and all the people who went out west, they needed the Jews to provide all of their provisions and clothing for them. But the Jewish community in Denver grew. By 1927, there were 17,000 Jews in Denver. And after the Second World War, especially in the 60s and 70s and then the 80s, the Orthodox community grew in Denver, specifically not only the modern Orthodox community, but there was a right-wing Orthodox community as well. There actually was a yeshiva in Denver for young men, for what we would call boys and girls. And I remember when I was in high school that everybody from the West seemed to go to this yeshiva in Denver. So it was an important Orthodox center. But on the other hand, in the the late 1970s, between 1975 and 1980, the intermarriage rate in Denver was over 72%. Now, that's a crazy number, 72%, especially when you consider the fact that there was a strong Orthodox community and a strong Haredi community, right-wing Orthodox community. So their intermarriage rate was next to zero. So it means that the left of Orthodox community, the intermarriage rate was very, very high. Now, this is important to understand. Up to now, we've talked about situations where the intermarriage rate was such that the question was, should you encourage conversion? Because by encouraging conversion, maybe you're encouraging intermarriage. Now, that's an issue if intermarriage is 5% or 10% or 20%. You don't want to encourage intermarriage. But if intermarriage is in the 70% rate, then all of a sudden, conversion plays a completely different role. It's not that you don't want to encourage conversion, but the question is maybe you want to encourage conversion because the more people who convert, the fewer people who are going to intermarry. So this is a critical turning point in the American Jewish attitude towards conversion. That the rate of conversion, the rate of intermarriage is so high that conversion actually has the potential to serve as a, way to fight intermarriage by making sure that the weddings are in weddings because the person converted and therefore a Jew is marrying another Jew. Okay. With that, I want to tell you a story. In the 1970s in Denver, there was an unofficial relationship between Rabbi Stephen Foster, who was a Reform rabbi in Denver, and Rabbi Jerome Lipsitz, who was one of the Orthodox rabbis. Rabbi Foster used to send his Reform converts to Rabbi Lipsitz, and Rabbi Lipsitz used to convert them, get two other Orthodox rabbis and convert them with some kind of loose understanding that they would be observant. Now, that relationship, actually, you know, that's a tricky relationship. Because for an Orthodox rabbi to convert somebody who studied, who comes from the Reform movement, means that they're both technically in terms of observance, but also sociologically in terms of the working together with the Reform movement was potentially very much suspect within the community. In 1976, these rabbis, Rabbi Foster and Rabbi Lipsitz, shared this arrangement with the Denver Rabbinic Council. The Denver Rabbinic Council was like the New York Board of Rabbis. It was the Board of Rabbis that had as its members Orthodox, conservative, and Reform rabbis. When they shared this arrangement with the Denver Rabbinical Council, there was some appeal by some of the non-Orthodox, and there was some opposition specifically by the Orthodox who thought that Orthodox rabbis should not be converting people who come from the Reform movement. Let's put that on hold for one second. The following year, 1977, there were two guest speakers in Denver. And again, Denver is a small Jewish community. So the guest speakers are brought not just for the Orthodox, but they're brought and, you know, and attracted members of all the different denominations. The first was Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz. Rabbi Berkovitz was an important Orthodox philosopher from Chicago, someone who was very well respected within the Orthodox community. And his talk was about At that time, there was an argument in Israel, famous, about who is a Jew. And Rabbi Berkowitz said that the who is a Jew debate is destroying Jewish unity. And he basically gave a lecture about the importance of Jewish unity. Around the same time, Rabbi Shlomo Ritzkin, who was then the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue, he came and he actually talked about conversion. And he said that conversion is an ongoing process, is not just a process that ends with going to the mikvah, but something that needs to be a lifelong commitment. Now, these two lectures seem to have gotten the rabbinic community talking again about conversion and what they can do to fight intermarriage through conversion. And therefore, several weeks after Rabbi Ritzkin spoke in 1977, seven rabbis, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, gathered in a hotel conference room outside of Denver. They ordered a kosher lunch, and they agreed that they would not leave that conference room until they came up with a solution to the conversion / intermarriage problem. These seven rabbis spent 10 hours in that conference room, and they came out with the following plan. They said that a conversion candidate in Denver would be required to take a 22-week conversion course. Obviously, in 1977, that was an in-person 22-week conversion class. That class would be taught by rabbis from the different denominations. The sponsoring rabbi during those 22 weeks would provide personal instruction and counsel. So basically, the way the preparation would look is that anybody who wanted to convert within the Denver community, who approached one of these seven rabbis, would enroll in the 22-week class that would be taught by all the different rabbis, and would be counseled and instructed by their own rabbi, whether that rabbi is Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. A panel of three rabbis, one Orthodox, one Conservative, and one Reform, would then evaluate the candidate. If that candidate passed the evaluation, and it doesn't sound like there was going to be a test, they would just be interviewed by this panel. Then three Orthodox rabbis would serve as the Beit Din at the mikvah, at the bris and at the mikvah, for women just at the mikvah. And the certificate would be signed by the three Orthodox rabbis. That was the deal. Now, what were these candidates required to commit to? They were told to commit to what they called the 10 commitments, which is kind of cute. They had a promise, number one, to fast on Yom Kippur. Number two, to join a shul. Number three, to light Shabbos candles. Number four, to light Hanukkah candles. Number five, to support Israel, whatever supporting Israel meant in 1977. And number six, to commit themselves to charity, that they didn't have to make a donation to this rabbinic group. They just had to commit themselves to charity. Intentionally, these 10 commitments were vague about keeping kosher and about observing Shabbos. They had to light Shabbos candles, but this was vague in terms of in terms of their obligation to keep Shabbos. Now, I want to just pause for 1 second. Again, this is what we have been doing. To take 1 minute if there's a comment. When you hear this arrangement, how does it sound 50 years later, 48 years later? How does this arrangement sound to you? Any thoughts? Okay, so no thoughts. I'll tell you what they thought about it and then.
I'll give you a thought. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't,
let me hear a thought.
It sounds like in some ways it would be heaven nowadays, because most people, since then, people don't even think about converting. They fall in love with somebody of a different religion, and whoever, they may raise the kids in one of the religions who the parent cares more about. Or they may raise them in both, or they may raise them in none. And most people who aren't Orthodox don't belong to a synagogue at all, unless it's time for a bar.
So it's better. It's better. At least you'll have an Orthodox conversion for people who wouldn't have any conversion at all, or definitely wouldn't have an Orthodox conversion. Good. You say someone just wrote on the chat, at least there's potential. Okay, maybe there's potential. Anybody not like this idea?
I don't like the idea.
Let me hear one person. Who doesn't like the idea?
I don't like it. The converts won't be Jewish, but their children will think they are, and it's...
Here we go. It's misleading, right, Rabbi Silverberg? It's misleading, because they think they have an Orthodox conversion, but since they're not Orthodox, so they're not going to really be converts, and therefore they're going to have children, and their children won't be Jewish, and they'll marry Jews, and they'll say they're Jewish, but they're not really Jewish. All sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Correct. So let me tell you. Obviously, the discussion here is a discussion that they were having at the time. The first thing is that the right of center Orthodox community rejected it out of hand. The yeshiva community in Denver thought this was the worst thing that could happen. Generally speaking, but we have to talk about this for a minute because this is important. You see, intermarriage wasn't a factor in their community, right? They didn't have intermarriage. So to be lenient on conversion within that community didn't make any sense at all. There was no reason that they were going to be lenient on conversion, considering the fact that they didn't, that they didn't feel intermarriage was a problem. But interestingly, there was also opposition from the Reform movement, because they were insulted that the Reform rabbis weren't allowed to sign the certificate, right? In the end, the rabbis at the mikvah were the Orthodox rabbis. And the rabbis who signed the certificate were the Orthodox rabbis, which clearly was a nod to the Orthodox, saying that if you want a real conversion, you need an Orthodox conversion. That was insulting to the Reform movement. So they were insulted that way also. Okay? Now, what worked? I'll just tell you a parenthesis for a second. Okay, I'll tell you a story. It's not a secret, because they wrote about this story in the New Yorker article. I participated in a conversion about a year and a half ago. And it was someone who was Orthodox, who was converted and wanted to be Orthodox and was Orthodox, but who was friendly with a Reform rabbi and wanted the Reform rabbi to be part of the whole process. And when I asked the Reform rabbi, whether she would want to be part of the process, want to come to the mikvah, what she told me was that she wanted to bring her own betin. I laughed because I thought about Denver, because that was exactly what the Reform said in Denver. Why do you tell me that you want me to be part of the process? If you want me to be part of the process, I want to bring my own betin. So for this conversion that we did a year and a half ago, so there was an Orthodox conversion, and she had a Reform certificate too. But they didn't do that in Denver. The certificate was only an Orthodox conversion, only an Orthodox certificate, and the conversion was only you know, considered to be an Orthodox conversion. The Reform were upset about that. So this went on, 1977 to 1982. In 1982, after 5 years, there was a progress report that was written. Of the 130 converts who had come through the system. Now, I don't really have a feel about how successful that was. That's about, right, so that's 5 years. That's about 30 converts a year, 35 converts a year. I don't have a sense of, you know, what was going on beforehand. But that's 130 converts over 5 years. 94 came from the Reform movement, and only 8 came from Orthodox rabbis. The others came from other denominations. 94 Reform and 8 Orthodox. And the Orthodox were upset. They said that even though it had been set up that everybody taught the class and that a panel of 3 rabbis, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, met with the convert, the Orthodox rabbi said that often they were meeting their converts for the first time in the mikvah. And the Orthodox rabbis began to feel as if they were being taken advantage of, that they were being asked to sit on a conversion betin basically for Reform Jews, even though they themselves were not actually educating these Reform Jews. So the Orthodox rabbis, they didn't stop the program. The program continued. But the Orthodox rabbis were not happy with the way that the program had taken shape. In addition, there were a couple of other issues that arose. In December 1982, the Reform movement decided to start a project called Project Outreach. It was a project to educate non-Jews and to encourage them to convert. And Denver was chosen as a trial city for this program. Now, wow, that's really on the edge, right? We know we have a tradition that Judaism is not a proselytizing religion. We don't go out and try to convince people to convert to Judaism. Truth of the matter is that that may not always have been the case. It might have been that during the period of the Hashmonaim, that Jews actually did go out and try to convince people to convert. But at least ever since we're a minority during the Roman period, we don't go out and try to convince people to convert. And therefore, the Orthodox and conservative rabbis rejected this program. They said, this program is anti-Judaism. This is proselytizing. That is against Judaism. Now, I just want to defend the Reform program for a minute. From the perspective of the Reform program, from the effect of the Reform, agenda, this made a lot of sense. Because again, 70% intermarriage rate. What better way to fight the 70% intermarriage rate than to convince people to convert? If you convince people to convert, then you'll have more in marriages and you'll have less intermarriage. So I understand where they were coming from. I also understand with the Orthodox and Conservative why they opposed this program. And finally, in March 1982, the Reform movement and the rabbinic group of the Reform movement, what they call the CCAR, which is the Reform RCA, adopted patrilineal descent. Patrilineal descent meant that if either one of your parents is Jewish, then the children are Jewish, even if only your father is Jewish. So all of a sudden, the rules of conversion are thrown up in the air because the Reform movement wasn't limiting itself to matrilineal descent. They were willing to accept a Jew whose father was Jewish. Now, this together with the fact that most of the converts in this program were Reform, this led to a lot of misgivings within the Orthodox rabbinic community. On June 17th, 1983, 6 years after that 10-hour meeting in the conference room of the hotel, the Denver Rabbinical Council met. Unbeknownst to the conservative and Reform rabbis on this council, the Orthodox rabbis had been meeting secretly for several months. And at this meeting, the Orthodox rabbis announced that the Orthodox rabbis were withdrawing from this conversion program. Too many converts, they said, too many compromises. We're going to read Rabbi Wagner's letter to this, in which they resigned in a couple of minutes, but I just want to finish telling the story. Now, Rabbi Foster, who again was one of the, he was the originator of this idea, the Reform rabbi with Rabbi Lipsitz, the Orthodox rabbi. Rabbi Foster felt ambushed. He said, I had no chance to save the program. I had no chance to defend myself. You came in, he said to the Orthodox rabbis, you had already made your decision. So he was unhappy with what happened. In the end, over 6 years, there were 175 conversions, almost entirely conversions that came from the non-Orthodox movement. Now, once this program, what's interesting is the project only became known after the Orthodox resigned, right? That's not surprising. When it was happening, people around the country didn't know about it. But when the Orthodox resigned, all of a sudden, everybody knew about it. And Moshe Scherer, who was the head of the Aguda, he said the program was mind-boggling. He couldn't believe it. But the most interesting reaction came from the Rabbinical Council of America, the Orthodox rabbinical group. The rabbi of the Rabbinical Council of America in 1983 was Rabbi Gilbert Klapperman. Rabbi Klapperman was the rabbi of Beth Shalom in Lawrence. And he actually raised the question about the three Orthodox rabbis who had participated in this program. He said that their participation in the program raised serious question about their credibility and their integrity as a rabbis. And these three rabbis were actually called to New York to appear before the Rabbinical Council of America and to defend their position. In the end, they were not thrown out of the RCA. But the fact that they were called to New York to defend themselves shows that the RCA was not at all happy with what they did. Now, just to be fair, there wasn't only opposition from within Orthodoxy. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg wrote an article. The article was called Tragedy in Denver. The tragedy was that the program was canceled. And Rabbi Haskell Lookstein wrote that the collapse is a tragedy for American Jewry. So there were Orthodox rabbis, and I can tell you firsthand that Rabbi Lookstein was doing private Orthodox conversions at that time, that they understood that the Denver conversion program, someone wrote in the chat at the beginning, that it had potential. They understood that it had potential, right? There was something to be said about this program. And the liberal Orthodox rabbis, Rabbi Lookstein and Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, they understood the tragedy in the fact that the program no longer happened. Now, just to give you a sense of afterwards, you should know that in 1997, which is a whole 15 years later, the intermarriage rate in Denver is still over 70%. So I don't know what would have happened had the program continued. But clearly, the problem of intermarriage in Denver was not resolved by this program. It was an attempt. It was an interesting attempt, but it did not solve the problem in Denver. Now, what I want to look at now, so I told you a story, but we need to see, was anything written about this project? Were there any interviews that took place? So again, during the project, nobody spoke about it. But once the project was canceled, the Intermountain Jewish News, which was the Jewish week of Denver, published a special 12-page section on the program. And it interviewed all the rabbis, Orthodox, conservative, and Reform, about the program. And it has some amazing material for us. So what I want to do today is I want to look at this material. It actually, fascinatingly, is going to include a tshuva by Rabbi Wagner as well. Before I turn over the screen, again, 1 minute if somebody wants to say something.
Yeah. Before COVID in Skokie, Illinois, the YU Kollel had a program for women about women converts. And they had, it was either two or three women. Their stories were all the same, and they were from women now, covered their hair, all of that. They all had a couple of conversions. They either started out conservative Reform. They were Asian women. Their husbands couldn't care less about anything Judaism, but they wanted, for their family's sake, to have, you know, some kind of religion structure. So they started out with the non-Orthodox things. They got very interested in it, and they got more religious. They started keeping kosher. They started keeping Shabbat. It is a process. And then eventually they had an Orthodox conversion. Their kids all go to day school. They're all fine. So how, when you have nothing, when you get it to the point where nothing counts, where, you know, whatever, are you ever going to do it? It's a process. It's a spirit.
Good. I accept that. So, Shelley, I accept what you're saying. I just want to say, this is important to understand, those people who came to that session in Chicago are the minority of the minority. Most converts are not like that, right? Most converts are not, you know, don't, even though it's a journey, they don't end up where these people end up. And each one has their own unique story. And the question is, one, how to deal with the people who you met that day in Chicago. But you also have to talk about about people who don't fall into that category. People who aren't willing to be that Orthodox. Are we willing to make concessions to include them within Orthodox conversion or not? That's really the question that Denver dealt with. Okay. Let me share the screen and let's look at some absolutely remarkable material. Absolutely remarkable material. Here we go. Okay. First of all, I want to show you something. This is material from the American Jewish Archives. You see, box 62, folder 13, Denver Beit Din, background stories, Denver, Colorado, 1983 to 1989. I mean, that's when they got this material. The Beit Din was from 1977 to 1983. This material actually is available online now. I gave the sources. I have all the material here because just so we could have it for record, this material is amazing. So Denver's internationally unique joint conversion program breaks down. And now there's a summary. I want to just read the beginning and then I want to read some specifics. First of all, how many converts went through the joint conversion program in its 6 years of existence? Rabbi Stanley Wagner estimates 750. I mean, we know that that's not true. We know the number is 175. It's interesting that either there's a mistake there or that he estimated much higher because he wanted to make it seem as if the program was successful. That's an interesting question, why that number is so incorrect. What was the original impetus behind the program? For Rabbi Jerome Lipsitz, it was the encouragement of Rabbi Stephen Riskin. I think by then he was Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, rabbi of the Lincoln Square Synagogue in New York City. For Rabbi Bernard Eisenman, also an Orthodox rabbi, it was the encouragement of Rabbis Riskin and Eliezer Berkovitz, emeritus professor of Jewish philosophy at Hebrew Theological College. Both Rabbis Riskin and Berkovitz are Orthodox rabbis. I want to analyze this for a minute. But I asked the Orthodox rabbis what was the impetus? Why did you think it was a good idea? They don't answer it was a good idea because there's a crisis in Denver and there was 70% intermarriage rate. They say, no, Rabbi Riskin encouraged me to do it. Dr. Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz encouraged me to do it. You see, they're looking for Orthodox support. They want to say we did it because Orthodox rabbis said that it was important. It was very much important for them that they were within the Orthodox world, that they weren't outside the Orthodox world. I'll tell you that Rabbi Jerome Lipsitz was a rabbi in Denver, an Orthodox rabbi in Denver. His son, Rabbi Josh Lipsitz, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago, Josh Lipsitz went to high school with me in the second half of the 1970s. And we went to Rabbi Riskin's high school, Manhattan Hebrew High School in Riverdale. So I can tell you that Rabbi Lipsitz knew Rabbi Riskin very, very well. And he obviously was influenced by Rabbi Riskin. He sent his son all the way from Denver to Riverdale to go to high school. So I just want to tell you that we're talking about whether the reports are correct or not. I can tell you firsthand that Rabbi Lipsitz was very much influenced by Rabbi Riskin. And I wouldn't be surprised if Rabbi Riskin told him, you know, this is a great idea to have such a conversion program. So that's interesting. They look for the impetus was Orthodox rabbis, not the situation in Denver, but Orthodox rabbis. Now we go on. Why did it break down? So let's see what they say. So here we go. Why did the joint conversion program break up? Different reasons were offered by different rabbis, including disagreement over substantive theological issues, mainly patrilineal dissent. One of you commented in the chat. Yeah, patrilineal dissent. That's one opinion. Concern over the plan of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, the National Reform Congregational Body, to introduce in Denver a formal attempt, an outreach program to convert unchurched Gentiles. We've talked about that too. Personality conflicts among the rabbis. That's always a reason for everything. A fight over who had the most power in the community. No reason that could not have been resolved. Pressure from national rabbinical bodies and concern over the high number of Reform-sponsored converts considered to be Jewish by the Reform rabbinical body if the child is raised Jewishly. This breaks with the long-standing definition of a Jew as a person born of a Jewish mother, whether or not the child is actively raised as a Jew. The debate over matrilineal and patrilineal descent in Judaism is a major bone of contention among rabbis today. Shortly after the Reform rabbinical body passed its patrilineal resolution, an Orthodox rabbinical body, the RCA, deplored and denounced the resolution. This debate is uniquely poignant in Denver because it was only in this city that rabbis of different philosophical and theological persuasions actually cooperated openly and officially in a joint conversion program. A program touching the hearts of the issue of Jewish genealogy, as does the patrilineal-matrilineal debate. Because of its crucial role in American Judaism generally, and in the breakdown of Denver's joint conversion program particularly, The issue of patrilineal descent was raised equally with that of the joint conversion program in the Intermountain Jewish News' interviews through the program. One last thing. Will the joint conversion program be reestablished? The traditional rabbis describe the program retrospectively as a mistake. Other rabbis would like to see it reestablished, but do not expect that to happen, at least not in the near future. So let me tell you a couple of things here. I read that whole couple of paragraphs about why it broke down to show you that, you know what? It's not clear why it broke down, right? They get into a whole discussion about patrilineal. You know, they say they were arguing. It was a power fight. The rabbis didn't get along. There's generally a rule. And that is, if you want to know why something breaks down and you have six different reasons why it breaks down, so probably there was no one reason why it broke down. And I'm going to read you something which is interesting in a second. But what I would say is that the reason it broke down is because the idea initially was probably faulty. Right? The idea initially was probably fraught. And therefore, it just was a matter of time before it broke down. Sure, there were things that hastened its demise. But the reason it broke down is because from the beginning, it was something that was fraught, something that didn't seem to stick, something that the Orthodox couldn't possibly feel comfortable with. And I want to just show you something, which is also remarkable, that Rabbi Wagner wrote. Here we go. So Rabbi Wagner, one second. Look what Rabbi Wagner writes. I want to add to this a very important point. I think the lesson that we learned from this 6-year experience was that it's erroneous to build the idea of Jewish unity on religious or ideological compromises. There are 100 ways to build Jewish unity. We can work together for Israel, Jewish education. We can talk about reaching out to the unaffiliated. We can talk about defense, honor of the Jewish people. There are 100 ways to work for the Jewish unity in love and in respect without calling upon the Reform to compromise its ideals and the traditional to compromise. And therefore, to build a Jewish unity on the basis of such compromises is a very shaky foundation. And what's more, it literally prevented us from exploring the other avenues of unity and how we can work together. So we feel, at least the traditional rabbis feel, that rather than having the breakup of the conversion procedure destroy Jewish unity, it was the beginning of a process of creating a firmer Jewish unity, based not on religious compromise, but on a common assessment of the problems that face us as a community. Now that is a remarkable paragraph. The first interesting thing is Rabbi Wagner obviously is a very good rabbi. Because what Rabbi Wagner is able to do is to turn it positive. Don't look at the fact that the Denver conversion betin fell through. Don't look at that as something bad. Actually look at that as something good. Because now we can begin to unify on real terms. We can begin to work together on things that we can actually work together on. But I want to talk about the first half of this paragraph. What he says is that we can't build Jewish unity on theological issues or on what we would call halachic issues. That fundamentally is a mistake. There's no Jewish unity on halacha. The Orthodox accept halacha. The conservative have their own view. The Reform have their own view. We cannot build Jewish unity on halacha. Now, I want to take 1 second on that. What do we think about that? Can we build Jewish unity on halakha? Or 50 years later, 40 years later, do we still agree that if we work with the conservative and reform, we cannot work with them on halakha or theology? The only thing we can work with them on is kind of political issues or social issues. What do you think? Do we agree with that 40 years later, or we disagree with that? Any thoughts?
I would raise a question, which sort of is not direct, which is, you talked about political and social issues. I think the more difficult issue, which you'll do another course on, is institutional. The two that I'm most conscious of, and there's a whole history of, are first community day schools, and they vary. And
we'll talk about that next week. Okay. Next week we'll talk about community day school.
And the other one is precisely things like the rabbinical council. That is.
Okay. Good. So that's fair. Okay. But what about this idea that that can create Jewish unity across denominational lines on issues of theology and halakha? Right or wrong? Right or wrong?
Isn't that what Rabbi Soloveitchik said?
Yeah, that Rabbi Soloveitchik said that regarding the Christians, right? After Nostra Aetate in the 1960s, he wrote Confrontation, and he says, we can't talk to the Christians about theology. We can only talk to them about political or social questions. But what about the reform movement? What do you think? One more comment from somebody else. Anybody have an idea? So the answer is that I think that 40 years later, we still believe the same thing. I think within Orthodoxy does not want to, you know, have a conversation with the non-Orthodox about theology or halakha. We're happy to work with the non-Orthodox in other kinds of issues, social issues, Israel issue, political issues. But when it comes to halakha, then the Orthodox need to be separate. They can't create Jewish unity around halakha. Now, I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm not here to make a social comment. I'm just here to point out the fact that 40 years later, I think we're in exactly the same place that we were when the Denver Beis Din broke down in 1983. And one last question. You said that there's a question, right? The rabbinical groups, the day schools. There was a crisis. What was the crisis? You had 175 converts. The Denver Beis Din program broke down. What's the status of those 175 converts? You talked about the women who covered their hair in Chicago. What about if some of those women were converted by the Denver Beis Din and then went on to be frum? Would they need to be converted again, or were the conversions of the Denver Beis Din acceptable because three Orthodox rabbis saw them convert, even though they came from the Reform movement and they probably weren't as frum as they should be? That was a really serious question. And look what Rabbi Wagner does. This is really the best part of all. Rabbi Wagner actually writes a tshuva. You see, these are all these interviews. I just want to give it to you to show you. It's amazing. Okay, he writes a tshuva. Look at this. Preliminary draft. The Denver conversion process. The halachic validation by Rabbi Stanley M. Wagner. Just let me read the first paragraph. The purpose of this paper is to review the communal conversion procedure established by the Denver Rabbinical Council in 1977 probably, to provide the halakhic basis for Orthodox rabbinic participation in this program, and to establish the halakhic basis for the validation of the 176, there he has the number right, conversions performed under those circumstances and conditions. So basically the question is, Are these conversions acceptable? And look at this. This is remarkable. One page, two pages, three pages, four pages, five pages, six pages, seven pages, eight pages, nine pages, 10 pages, 11 pages. 11 pages. He talks about the halakha. And I want to read the end. For all of the reasons above, and for the more positive reasons mentioned by Chazal, who were affirmative in their attitude towards Kabbalas Gerim, including this mitzvah in the commandments of Avas Hager and Avas Hashem, and reminding us of biblical precedents for receiving converts, the Denver Orthodox rabbinate participated in our communal conversion process. Add in truth, although we were unhappy that we could not, to begin with, bring these converts to a higher level of mitzvah observance, we and they understood that the conversion was the beginning of a process of spiritual growth. We were furthermore more than satisfied that our converts would consider themselves fully part and parcel of the Jewish community, with many of them attaining a high level of mitzvah observance. Contrary to the press notices, we did not organize a conversion factory, and our converts were not phony. We withdrew the process, not because we felt that we were engaged in a program which did not have halakhic validity, but because the reform law and patrilineality placed a cloud over our unified efforts in issues of Jewish status. We appeal to you, therefore, not only to avoid impugning the legitimacy of our converts, b'di'evet, which in our estimation would certainly be contrary to the rov minyan u'binyan of poskim, which means the majority of poskim, but to avoid censoring us for our efforts, even though we engaged in this procedure without consulting either the RCA Beis Din or its leadership. We acted in good faith, lefi ra'ot einenu, in what we felt was in full accordance with the halakha. The participating Orthodox rabbis received no compensation whatsoever for their involvement, nor was there any communal pressure applied upon us to engage in this process, so that we had absolutely no ulterior motive for our commitment to this process. Finally, the issue before us is not whether there are yesh osrim, those who don't allow, with regard to any or all of the procedures we followed. What was attempted here was to demonstrate that our communal conversion process does have a halakhic basis, and that is Rabbanim Musmachim, we had the right in this case, we believe the responsibility to seek out those leniencies of our poskim, which would legitimize it halachically. The Eis Lassos actually permits a Heferu Torasecha, that we can turn over the Torah. But we felt within the bounds of Torah, although we recognized that we were in a gray zone halachically. As to our culpability in this endeavor, we conclude with Rabbi Uziel's citation in reference to judges who follow his guidance. Behu rachum yichaper avon. May God forgive us. That's a remarkable end of that tshuva. What Rabbi Wagner writes there is, we're not telling you that what we did was the preferred way of doing things. We're sorry also that they couldn't be Orthodox, that we couldn't train them and make them Orthodox. But given the situation and given the realities and given the intermarriage rate, we did the best that we can do. And we want you to respect the fact that we did the best that we can do. I think that maybe you talk about whether we're 40 years, where we are 40 years later. I think that that argument of Rabbi Wagner carried more weight in 1983 than it carries in 2025. The idea that we did the best that we can do and that, you know, b'dieved, you know, not preferably, but acceptable were our conversions. We also would have liked to do them better. We're sorry that we couldn't, but we had a responsibility to do what we did. He apologized, but at the same time, he supported and explained what the rationale for what they were doing. Someone just put in the chat that Rabbi Wagner was remarkable. Rabbi Wagner was actually remarkable, and Rabbi Wagner was courageous. The truth of the matter is that 40 years later, there still has been no program that has come close to Rabbi Wagner, to Rabbi Wagner's program in Denver. The intermarriage rates are the same, but no one has attempted a program like Rabbi Wagner's program in Denver. It wouldn't go anymore. Or maybe there are no courageous rabbis who are willing to try it like Rabbi Wagner tried. But I think that Rabbi Wagner and the Denver Rabbinical Council deserve a place in history, in the history of Orthodoxy in America, because we don't only write about the victories. We have to sometimes write about the defeats, because in the defeat here, in the fact that this conversion program didn't in the end work itself out, in the defeat was actually a big victory for how Rabbi Wagner and the Orthodox understood Orthodoxy, understood Halacha, and understood their responsibility to conversion. Thank you so much, as always, for coming. Next week, we're going to look at an amazing topic which you actually brought up, and that is, how did Jewish day schools in small towns in America, small cities in America, affect conversion? Meaning, were they more lenient regarding conversion of children because of a need to populate the Jewish day schools? It's an interesting question. See everybody next Tuesday.
Comments.
Thank you very much.
Yes, two comments.
Fascinating.
Two comments if I still may.
Yes.
Time has moved on, and I'm not aware of any help or connection between the what we call modern and what you call ultra-Orthodox. It would be interesting to analyze how these two groups.
Good. That is interesting. That's not this topic, but that is an interesting topic. Very good.
Okay. The other interesting topic, which would be also again tangential only, is what happened in, I think it was the 1950s, when there was an attempt to make a joint Beis Din with Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Shaul Lieberman.
Correct. That's interesting. Not this topic, but that is a fascinating topic. Thank you very much. Have a good week, everybody. We'll see you next week. Be well.